From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. This Thursday morning, North Carolina state legislators, including Representatives Ted Davis Jr. and Holly Grange of New Hanover County, and Senator Bill Rabin of Brunswick County, along with Attorney General Josh Stein, held a press conference to announce the introduction of the STOP Act. It's legislation intended to address the opioid epidemic in North Carolina by ensuring smarter prescribing and dispensing of highly addictive prescription drugs. The bill would also provide funding for treatment and recovery. According to statistics provided by the bill's sponsors, there's one opioid prescription written for each man, woman, and child in North Carolina. That's more than 705 million pain pills prescribed to North Carolinians in total. Four North Carolinians die from overdose each day, while 36 are hospitalized and 64 are taken to the ER. Drug overdose is now the number one cause of accidental death, beating car crashes. And one out of every 100 babies born in the state is born addicted to opioids. Here's the basic conundrum. How can the medical community effectively treat pain without unwittingly perpetuating the problem? Today, we're going to hear from medical professionals about promising alternatives, changing medical practices, and options available for pregnant women and the babies who are born addicted. With us today from the studios of Duke University, Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke is a tenured professor of neurology, anesthesiology, and neurobiology at Duke University Medical Center in Durham. He's also a scientist physician in charge of his own basic science laboratory in the Department of Neurology, and he's an attending physician at both the Duke Neurology Clinics for Headache, Head Pain, and Trigeminal Sensory Disorders at Maureen Road and the Duke Clinics for Innovative Pain Therapy at Briar Creek of the Department of Anesthesiology. Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke, welcome to Coastline.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to be on the air.
Also on our panel today, Dr. Joseph Pino. He's a physician and the vice president of graduate medical education at New Hanover Regional Medical Center and the executive director at the Southeast Area Health Education Center. Dr. Pino, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're also very glad to have Barbara Beekler. She's the administrator for the New Hanover Regional Medical Center, Betty H. Cameron Women's and Children's Hospital. Barbara Beekler, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Joseph Pino, let's put doctors who are simply making money illegally or unethically to the side for a moment. But what responsibility do you think the legitimate medical community bears when it comes to looking at their contribution to the current opioid epidemic?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question. And the reason why I say that is back in the mid-90s, some of our governing bodies looked at pain as our fifth vital sign. So some of the basics of asking what is your temperature, what is your heart rate and blood pressure, how fast are you breathing, and are you in any pain? And with the desire to be able to take care of the patients who present at the hospital or to one's clinic in a way that they will be pain-free. So over time, it was a goal to seek a pain-free patient, and that became complicated over time. You see, opioid and prescription pain medication are very effective, but for chronic long-term use, in some circumstances, they really aren't your friend. And as a consequence, it can create new problems. And so, yes, to a certain extent, yes, physicians and healthcare providers are providing prescription pain medicine in an effort to treat pain. And it's only recent where we're starting to see those governing bodies take a step back and say, you know, maybe we really have to rethink how we emphasize pain and pain management. And with that, it's a greater emphasis on perhaps non-traditional ways of managing pain, in addition to some of our tried-and-true strategies of non-prescription pain medication.
How long ago did the medical community, and I'm thinking specifically of people at New Hanover Regional Medical Center, because Wilmington has been held up as a paragon of opioid abuse. I realize that's an oxymoron in a sense. But when did you start noticing that there's a problem here?
Well, you know, it came into focus probably about a year ago when the Castlight study came out and said that Wilmington leads the nation in opioid misuse. And you have such a beautiful community here with such wonderful people and an outstanding medical facility and outstanding physicians and healthcare providers. And to have to look at that data and say, gosh, we're really that bad, was striking. So I think that's really when it crystallized for me, and it helped me to recognize. Now, having said that, yes, we have seen our fair share of patients who present to our hospital with prescription pain medication and substance abuse disorder, and that's another difficult problem.
Dr. Liedtke at Duke University Medical Center, since you specialize in treating pain, can you just talk to us about the importance of treating pain and why this is something of a conundrum for the medical community? What happens if pain goes untreated? Why can't you just tell patients to gut it out?
Well, so from my perspective, I come to see patients who suffer from cases of pain that are very, very severe and that are making such an impact on their life that that is not an option to, or the option to point toward that alternative, given the suffering that of patients who present in our clinics is not such a obvious therapeutic option.
What happens to a patient's life? Do you see diminished functionality in the patient's work life, or what do you see if the pain is not treated effectively?
Yes. Yeah, so pain that is pathologic, meaning that it overshoots the normal pain response to injury, to a medical procedure that is accompanied by some post-procedural pain or post-injury, post-accident pain, normally goes away after a while. And if the pain does not go away, then we designate it pathologic pain. So there is something not right with the system in the patient's body, in the patient's brain and spinal cord and nerves get this pain resolved. To the normal state of not having that pain. And when that happens, that is pathologic pain. Pathologic pain that is ongoing and that is untreated leads to severe disruption of a human being, of their functioning. Multiple organ systems are affected by that. The brain is affected by that. It's a chronic stress. It's a form of chronic stress that's greatly effective at disrupting sleep, disrupting circadian rhythm. With that ongoing and unmitigated, it in a high percentage leads to mood disorders, with depression, various forms of depression. With the forms of pain that I'm familiar with treating, which is trigeminal pain disorder, head face pain, the pain is not rarely so severe that patients are thinking about, are considering self-harm, including the worst option. And so in that respect, I see patients in whom the option of non-medical treatment or of just trying to find a measure to deal with it is rather limited. I want to make one disclaimer here, which is that I'm speaking as my own on my own behalf. I'm not representing the views of Duke University Medical Center or Duke University here.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And Dr. Lietke, if you could also explain why opioids have been such a good source of pain management for medical practitioners. Why have they been so popular?
Let me give you my take, but I would also want to pass that on to Dr. Pino and get his take on that. Maybe you are... I take a step back and see that from above, as from the perspective of a pain researcher. And patients coming to see me for trigeminal pain disorders and headache, head pain, in those circumstances, we are not very fond. We are not. We don't like opioids. And we also have the experience that patients come to us after they have seen several providers already with an experience where they know that there is some residual effect, or there's a little bit of an effect of this type of treatment or that type of treatment. And opioids, for example, for the treatment of migraine headaches, it's not such a helpful treatment. For the treatment of trigeminal pain disorders, the more, I'd say very, very roughly, the more neuralgic the pain gets, which is shooting, electrifying pain, horrible pain attacks that patients suffer, that puts them into this thinking about that. What is it all about, and self-harm, etc. Those pain attacks also are not so readily helped by treatment with opioids. However, on the other hand, let me give you an example.
Dr. Lietke, I'm sorry, I need to interrupt for a moment. That music you hear in the background means we're about to go to a 90-second break, so we'll come back and let you finish your point. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about the way the medical community is dealing with the opioid epidemic. With us today, Dr. Wolfgang Lietke of Duke University Medical Center, Dr. Joseph Pino of New Hanover Regional Medical Center, and Barbara Beekler of NHRMC's Women's and Children's Hospital. If you have a question for our guest today, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're learning more about prescribing practices, how they're changing within the medical community due to the explosion of opioid abuse across the country, how the epidemic is changing the way mothers and babies are affected and how they're treated. We're also hearing about new research that shows promising alternatives for pain management. With us today, Barbara Beekler, administrator for the New Hanover Regional Medical Center, Betty H. Cameron Women's and Children's Hospital, Dr. Joseph Pino. He's vice president of graduate medical education for NHRMC and executive director of CHEC. And Dr. Wolfgang Lietke, a scientist physician at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, in charge of his own basic science laboratory in the Department of Neurology. If you have a question, you can give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Lietke, just before we went to break, you were finishing up your point. Go ahead, sir.
I was in the middle of saying that recently we had a lecture here at Duke University at Grand Rounds given by a pain scholar and a pain physician, Dr. Pasternak of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and he, very, very good lecture that was also focusing on this problem. He asked the audience the question, so who's prescribing opioids? And so a lot of hands went up from the physicians in attendance. And then he said, and who believes that this still works and works pretty well? It was almost the same number of hands that went up. So they see that in the clinical practice, it is something that it's just, despite this enormous difficulty in the crisis we have. In that auditorium in the morning in our Grand Rounds, there was a quorum where you had a good number of clinician providers who opined that for them it works and it looks as if it is working pretty well.
And Dr. Lietke,
certainly people are very, very obviously attentive to these problems we are having.
Yes. Did I understand you correctly when in the last segment you said that opioids may not be the best answer for managing some of this chronic pain?
That depends on the form of pain.
Okay. Okay. And we'll get into how you determine whether an opioid is the answer or not. But first, I want to get to Barbara Beekler with the Women's and Children's Hospital at NHRMC. Can you paint the picture for us of what you're seeing in terms of how the opioid epidemic is affecting pregnant women, mothers, and newborn babies?
Yes. Several years ago, we began to notice that there was an increased number of babies that were experiencing neonatal abstinence syndrome. So it was a baby that was exposed to an opioid while their mother was pregnant. And in 2013, we really started the first initiatives to look at how we are caring for those patients, what we can do to support mothers and babies more effectively. We have a team of interdisciplinary, interagency, really across several counties that came together to start talking about what can we do differently to really support these moms and babies. And so, unfortunately, that number has continued to increase. In 2015, we had 140 babies at the hospital that experienced neonatal abstinence syndrome. 2016 dropped a little, but based on our first the first quarter of 2017, it looks like that's going to come back up again to as many as 170 babies this year that we will see with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And so that mother, who is often on replacement therapy, so either methadone or Subutex, comes to the hospital, and that is actually her treatment is the exposure that the baby has had. And so we provide that care for mom and baby and make every effort to keep them together. What we know is that babies that are experiencing neonatal abstinence do better when they have a loving, consistent caregiver, and that person absolutely is the mother. So the environment at the hospital is perfect because every room is a private room with a sleep sofa for mom. We support that woman or her family being able to stay with the baby and thus provide that critical bonding time for mom and baby, giving mom the best opportunity to continue her therapy.
Do you always know if a mom is on methadone, she's struggling to shake her opioid addiction, she's on methadone, is that baby always going to suffer when that baby is born from neonatal abstinence syndrome?
No, the baby is not. Our protocol is that we observe the baby for a minimum of 5 days. We don't want to send a baby home that will then begin experiencing neonatal abstinence syndrome after they're out of our care. So we observe for 5 days, and many of the babies, again, based on some new protocols that we've put in place with keeping those moms and babies together, supporting that bonding and care and the environment that the newborn needs, has reduced the number of babies over the last few years that really required their own replacement therapy in order to withdraw from the opioid exposure.
And this is a relatively new understanding from medical staff that having mom there with the baby is an important part of that baby's care, especially if the baby is suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome. Because I can hear the voices already, the judging voices saying, well, this person is addicted to opioids, possibly addicted to heroin, possibly multiple substances. How can that be good for the baby?
Well, I would answer that in one way by saying, how can a mother not be good for a baby? It's interesting that we've done lots of research over the years about keeping moms and babies together. And I've never understood why we needed research to know that mothers were good for babies. But I do understand that response, and we see that. One of the things that we've done over the last few years at the hospital is make sure that every nurse and every physician, everyone who is coming into contact with these patients, was well informed about substance use and addiction to allow them to break away from that judgment that so often happens and rather embrace that woman, embrace the family. And by doing so, we keep her at the hospital. we keep her feeling good about herself and the care that we're providing, keep her with her baby, and then the long-term picture is just better for both of them.
Do you think there are some women who in the past might not have come to the hospital to seek medical treatment because they were concerned about possible consequences?
I think that has occurred in the past, and certainly there are parts of the country or moments in time where there's been concern about, you know, will I be arrested? Will they take my baby away? And I believe that's really been reduced. We have an excellent partnership with our Department of Social Services here in New Hanover County, and they are very focused on supporting families, keeping families together, providing services that really help women and families be successful in their treatment of substance use disorder. And so no woman needs to be concerned that if she seeks care or seeks treatment, that there will be any legal repercussions for her.
Even if the baby is born with obvious issues, neonatal abstinence syndrome or other issues from abuse, substance abuse, but the mother cannot be charged with any kind of crime?
The mothers are not charged with any kind of crime. And when you say other issues, neonatal abstinence syndrome is the issue, and we are very good at treating that with the environment, with replacement therapy, weaning that therapy. And so the babies, amazingly enough, the babies do not experience long-term consequences from that opioid exposure, not developmentally, not physiologically. The new research really indicates that if there is any concern for the baby long-term, it's related to the social economic situation of the family and not really related to any exposure to opioids in utero.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about how medical professionals are handling the opioid epidemic. Our guest today, Dr. Wolfgang Lietke, physician and scientist at Duke University Medical Center, Dr. Joseph Pino, physician and vice president of graduate medical education at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. He's also the executive director of CHEC, and Barbara Beekler, administrator of NHRMC's Women's and Children's Hospital. And they're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Pamela from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure. What's your question?
Should I just say my question?
Go right ahead. Yes.
Okay. My concern is, my husband is 60 years old. He has really bad rheumatoid arthritis in his hands, and it affects different joints also. But he is a carpenter, and he works with his hands, and he's in constant pain. But the only thing that he has found that works, that he can take and work and function, are Percocet, which is an opioid and Tylenol combination. And none of the doctors that he's gone to will prescribe him these, so he has to buy them, buy the pills, the Percocets, illegally. And I think it's a shame because he's 60 years old, and, you know, he has tried every other, thing that they've thrown at him, steroids, which keep him up, he can't sleep. They don't work very long. You can't really take them long term. And I understand, I broke my arm once and, they gave me stuff, but that was a pain that went away. So, I took the Percocets as needed.
Well, let's get a reaction from Dr. Pino here. Dr. Pino of New Hanover Regional Medical Center, when you hear a situation like this, what would you say to Pamela?
Right. So it sounds like your husband has a complicated medical history made worse by longstanding rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely correct. Historically, our medications have had their own set of side effects. And it's interesting for that particular disease process over the last several years, there's been a profusion of drugs to hit the market that actually target therapy from an immunologic standpoint, addressing it not necessarily like a nuclear bomb, but like a precision instrument. And so the newer medications actually have shown great promise in that particular disease process. And that would be something that I would be encouraging your husband or someone with rheumatoid arthritis to seek attention, especially from a rheumatologist, because these drugs are entering the market at such a rapid pace, and this is an area of expertise for that particular specialty. But I hear you loud and clear, right? And so he has pain that is difficult to manage, and the goal is to allow him to remain functional. But, you know, it's very tricky because when you start pain medicine over time, people get used to it. And then you have to talk about dose escalation. And it becomes more difficult. I'm not saying that this is the case with your husband, but simply put, that over time, you run the risk of seeing a person on astronomically high doses of these medicines. That comes with its own consequences.
He maintains, I don't know the milligram or whatever, but he maintains like just a normal, you know, he takes like two pills a day and he stays on that. You know, that's what he takes and that's what works and he can work. And that's the only thing that has worked. And I just, you know, at his age, I don't understand what is the harm in him being prescribed this and, you know, so that he can keep on working.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we bought a home, and if he doesn't have it, he has to...
And doctor...
You know, power tools.
Hang on one second, Pamela. Dr. Lietke, you see some patients, do you not, who suffer from chronic pain, who have been helped in a similar way to Pamela's husband? In other words, their functionality is stabilized at least or increases because they are on long-term opioids. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's my question.
I think in a phone call that led up to this show, I discussed with your colleague that there are a number of patients who come to see us in our clinics who are being treated with opioids long-term for a pain disorder, and that with the appropriate monitoring and following the guidelines of the North Carolina Medical Board, which we are required to do, and we do, we are hyper compliant with those, we follow these patients following these guidelines, and we treat them with the opioids that they receive, and we have observed successful management with these drugs in certain cases where patients were able to keep their function, keep their functions on the job, keep their functions socially, keep their function with their families, and it went with the opioids. And we observed that long-term use of the opioid under this medical supervision also went well, and that we did not drop on these alarming signs that patients got habituated. Patients lost the efficiency of the opioid was lost, or paresis, obstipation of the intestinal tract developed. These worrisome things that can happen when you use opioids longer term. We observed that these things went well, which made me think about whether there are possibly people, possibly patients out there who can be treated with opioids well, and that one other innovation that medicine will have to offer, or is currently offering in its development, is personalized medicine. So that we'd be able to possibly, hopefully, in the near, not too distant future, identify patients who can be more safely treated and others in whom opioids would be really, really worrisome and unsafe to use, and make that call right ahead and not by trying it out and then seeing, okay, you do well 1 year later. Oh, and you... In your case, we unfortunately have gotten into a calamity. So personalized medicine is an answer to that in terms of what new developments might be up there. And then one final word with a caller is that it's a perilous situation to do things that are not in keeping with the law. So I would also encourage to seek specialized help with rheumatology experts, as Dr. Pino has suggested, so to see whether some of the newer rheumatoid arthritis treatments might kick in and might be able to take away the need to use an opioid in a way that sounds a little bit alarming to me.
Thank you.
But again, speaking from my own end and not representing the institution here.
Yes, understood. And we can also add that disclaimer to our website. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that call, Pamela. Dr. Pino, we have just a minute or so before we go to break, but can you just take us through sort of a basic how you assess a patient and what kinds of questions you would ask them before you decide whether you're going to prescribe an opioid and how that's changed in the last year since you realized this was an issue here?
Right. So you want to get an idea of what is the source of pain and how is it impacting a person's life. You want to have a better understanding of what has been tried and what has worked well and what has been tried and what has failed. And along the way, trying to understand some of the other more complicated or more nuanced issues a person may have. Perhaps if there's an underlying issue of behavioral health disorder, such as depression, or perhaps there's a history of substance abuse in the family. These are important pieces of a puzzle, but then more importantly, is there ways to manage this that will allow you to use maybe non-prescription pain medications and efforts like physical therapy, which more and more we're using and really finding benefits, and alternative means like acupuncture.
And we're going to talk more about some of those alternative means when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline talking today about how medical professionals are managing their part in the opioid epidemic, how they're treating pain. You can email us on this Thursday at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the opioid epidemic through the eyes of medical professionals. We're about to learn about some pain management alternatives, the evolving practice of treating pain, and patients who may be addicted to opioids. Our guest today, Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke, scientist physician at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, in charge of his own basic science laboratory in the Department of Neurology. Dr. Joseph Pino, physician and vice president of graduate medical education at New Hanover Regional Medical Center and the executive director of CHEC. And Barbara Beekler, administrator of the NHRMC Betty H. Cameron Women's and Children's Hospital. They're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And before we jump back into opioids, this is slightly off topic but related. I've gotten two emails asking about considering the statistics regarding opioid abuse and overdose. What about medical marijuana? Are physicians inclined to look to medical marijuana alternatives? And are state legislators possibly moving towards that? Barbara Beekler.
What I would like to say about marijuana is that for women who are pregnant, it is much more dangerous than an opioid. And we've come to believe that marijuana is sort of the drug that's out there that really isn't that bad. And in reality, there are long-term brain changes and developmental problems associated with babies whose mothers have smoked marijuana during their pregnancy. And so since you brought that up, I really want to make sure that women in the community know that marijuana, along with alcohol and smoking, are incredibly dangerous long-term side effects to an unborn baby.
Long-term side effects, as opposed to what we know about neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Yes, ma'am.
And what do we know in terms of long-term or short-term effects?
Developmental delays, brain changes that would ultimately mean maybe the child doesn't learn as well as another child, some learning disabilities, some physical changes with, you know, balance or walking, that kind of thing. I'll ask my colleague, Dr. Pino, to maybe step in and share what he knows about that as well. But I know.
You're talking about smoking. You're talking about smoking marijuana, and you're talking about abusing alcohol.
Absolutely.
Using alcohol at all. When it comes to a mother who is on replacement therapy for her opioid addiction.
Absolutely.
There's a difference, though, with a baby who's born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. That baby's chances are brighter than those babies who are born from moms who are abusing tobacco, marijuana, and alcohol.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Liedtke, what are opioid receptors? And how does our new understanding, or more accurately, your new understanding of what they look like and how they function, open up new pharmacological possibilities?
Opioid receptors belong to the family of so-called G-protein-coupled receptors, GPCRs. In that respect, we have to mention my Duke colleague, Dr. Robert Lefkowitz, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on this type of receptors. And Dr. Lefkowitz has also worked on opioid receptors, given their relevance and importance. And it is through his work on this type of signaling mechanism that we understand a little better what is going on, and that the opioid receptor, the one that is targeted with drug therapy, so-called mu opioid receptor, mu opioid receptor, that's a key receptor for fighting and abating the pain. But on the other hand, that is also the type of opioid receptor that is linked to the reward system in the brain, and therefore that is the possible wire to danger that can lead to a patient becoming habituated and feeling rewards through the application of opioids, and therefore sort of plunging the patient into a state of being addicted to the opioid. So if you want to call it like that, it's a yin and yang that is mediated through the same molecule. And it's a receptor, so it's on the surface of cells, and the opioid, the drug or the natural compound binds to this receptor, and then it acts like a switch, as if you switch on the light in a room, or you switch on the first switch in a cascade, and then what follows in that cascade is happening inside the nerve cells. So opioid receptor acts within nerve cells powerfully to set them and reset them to do certain things. And one of the things that they do is they block or they inhibit the pain signal that comes from the periphery where pain is felt, for example, where the tooth has been pulled, where the bone has been broken, where the joint has been inflamed. That signal is guided to the nervous system through the nerves, which act like cables. And then within the nervous system, there's a transmission of this pain signal. The pain signal can be greatly attenuated when the opioid receptor is kicking in. So it acts like a tuning knob to how the pain signal is transmitted. But on the other hand, it also acts like a tuning knob, how reward is being felt, and reward is the key that it can lead to a state of being addicted.
And there's research going on in China that takes a peptide chemistry approach, fusing different peptides together to change the molecule that acts as a pain receptor.
There's research going on around the world because the worldwide research community has understood that the opioid crisis is killing people and that research efforts into this have to be doubled and tripled and potentiated to provide better answers. And part of that is our colleagues in China, and I gave this example to your colleague on the phone when we spoke before the show, and that is there is another type of receptor that is called the neuropeptide F receptor. And when that one is activated and switched on at the same time with a mu opioid receptor, that obviously has an effect that it possibly doubles or it enhances the anti-pain effects. And on the other hand, it counteracts the problems with a reward pathway. So that looks like a very, very attractive solution in that the anti-pain effects are maintained and the reward effects that can guide a human or an animal into a state of addiction is being mitigated by that type of approach. And that was an approach that was discovered by Chinese colleagues who have worked on this and who have used small sequence of amino acids called peptides to get at this. And that's a rational way how to do that. You can play around with these peptides and then very systematically deconstruct what is going on. And they have done very well in this field so far. But that is an exemplar of a worldwide concerted action of neurobiologists and clinical neuroscientists and laboratory-based neuroscientists who are interested in solving this problem.
And there's also been, I think, a policy agreement between Beijing and Washington, D.C., when it comes to trying to address it from a regulatory point of view. So we absolutely are seeing the evidence of worldwide cooperation on this. And Dr. Wolfgang Liedtke of Duke University Medical Center, you discovered PRPB4, an ion channel?
I first described the TRPV4 ion channel now 16, almost 17 years ago. And I have kept working on this molecule ever since. And the TRPV4 ion channel is also involved in pain, how pain is sensed and how pain is transmitted, so that if we can shut this ion channel down, that is another way how we can address the issue of pain transduction and transmission. And since there are not yet any drugs that we can prescribe, that we can use, or natural compounds that effectively do this, this is an area where I see some promise how we can possibly find new ways to treat pain and chronic pain that would take us out of this more risky business of prescribing opioids to patients with chronic and pathologic pain.
How far off is a new drug that might be able to have the same pain-reducing impact as an opioid, but that doesn't trigger the same kind of addictive response?
That depends on the type of drug that you have in your crosshairs here. If it's a completely new molecule that inhibits a new signaling pathway, for example, TRPV4 inhibitor, and that has to go through the regulatory channels and has to overcome the regulatory hurdles, we are talking about 5 to 10 years, I'd say relatively easily. But that there could possibly be a change for the need to restructure the regulatory landscape and at least consider how this landscape could be sculpted so that we might have a way to get there earlier without jeopardizing the safety of our patients.
Are you talking about the drug approval process when you refer to the regulatory landscape?
Yes.
Okay. You're listening to...
Science can produce solutions that come out of a lab where we say, here is a candidate. This is a candidate molecule, a candidate peptide, a candidate antibody. That can be produced by science. And that is, that you know, as scientists, we have to follow the discovery process. But that is dependent on financial support and money. I think the energy and the brain power to move this forward is unmitigated and enthusiastic and ready. It's a money factor.
When we look at the policy landscape, which is changing in North Carolina, at the top of the show we talked about the fact that a group of senators and representatives, some of them from the Cape Fear region, have now filed this legislation called the STOP Act, which is designed to further regulate and change some of the prescribing practices, Dr. Pino, of opioids. I'm just looking at some of the main points of this bill. It does allow $20 million for treatment and recovery, but it seems to be more about how physicians are prescribing these drugs. First of all, tell us what the substance abuse registry is, and is that related to this kind of legislation and how you as a physician will have to practice?
Right. So in the state of North Carolina, like many other states, we have a online controlled substance database. So physicians and healthcare providers can check and see if a patient is receiving pain medicine, where that person is getting it, that prescription filled, and also determine who is prescribing the pain medicines for that particular individual. And so that's a pretty helpful tool to identify what medicines some patients are receiving and where they're receiving them. And so while this bill has just been introduced, I'm not familiar with the exact terms. My understanding is that there's a desire for all physicians and healthcare providers to use this database, which on the surface seems like a really good fit. And so I guess the devil will be in the details to understand how that's going to be understood, that someone has looked into it, and moreover, who is going to be compelled to do this? Is it the healthcare provider? Is it the medical assistant is allowed to do it and provide the physician or healthcare provider with that information?
And there's also a point here that says establishing maximum limits for initial prescriptions of Schedule 2 through 5 controlled substances. Is that something that has been on your radar? Does that worry you as a physician?
Well, it depends. So for acute pain, one would say a limited supply of pain medicine certainly makes sense. Whereas if someone is on pain medicine for a longer period of time, having the ability to provide a one-month supply would be ideal. I don't know the exact pain pill number that the legislation recommends, but it's always difficult to make broad-reaching statements and then yet apply them in the office setting with a patient right across from you.
Especially as you're talking about personalizing pain management strategies in a way that you haven't really done before.
Right, exactly. So you heard my colleague talk about how our mutual experiences would support that some people do well with chronic opioid medications and don't fall into some of the untoward consequences that can occur. And so in those circumstances, it would make sense to be able to prescribe a month's supply of medication. And I'm not sure exactly what the limitation is as far as the number of pills that can be prescribed based upon that particular bill being put forth. But I think that detail will be important to kind of resolve.
Well, just a minute or so left. I want to get to some community outreach. What is happening now in the community? You've had discussions to raise community awareness around this.
Absolutely. Dr. Pino and I have worked together with lots of agencies across the New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender County to look at where is the support that's needed. You know, I hear about regulation and certainly focusing on regulating how we prescribe medications is good, but what's going to make a difference is backing this problem up to the young woman with her children and the support that they receive to really recover from that opioid use disorder and thereby allowing those children to have a future that is much brighter than it otherwise would have been. And so I worry about focus on regulation versus supporting our community and supporting our citizens.
And we'll also put some resources on our website when we post this. That's this edition of Coastline. Barbara Beekler, Dr. Joseph Pino, and Dr. Wolfgang Lietke. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Many thanks also to Duke University for making their studios available to us. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast on iTunes. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.